to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Well, as folks start to join us, I want to welcome you. My name is Larry Jacobs. I direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Before we begin, I want to just give you strong encouragement to participate. You'll see at the bottom of the screen, there's a Q&A button. That's your opportunity to jump in. We're going to get to as many questions as possible, as you'll see. Also, I want to let you know right next to that Q&A button, there's a transcript button, which will give you a closed transcript of today's conversation, and feel free to use that. Personnel is policy. Washington insiders decode appointments in the Trump administration, Republican Congress. This is a roadmap for what will now be playing out in Washington, D.C. Delighted to be joined by Trent Lefkowitz, who's a senior vice president in the Mercury firm's Washington, D.C. office. He closely monitors congressional activity and is a real expert on what is happening in real time. We're also joined by my good friend and partner here at the Humphrey School, Vin Weber, who's also a partner at Mercury in Washington, D.C. Vin served in Congress from 1981 to 1993. He's also one of the most prominent and successful strategists in the Republican Party and is a favored bipartisan friend in the Democratic Party, working with many Democrats, often on important foreign policy projects and others. So without further ado, I want to thank Trent and Vin for joining us. Thank you.
Larry, I'll start out. Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and it's always a pleasure to be talking to a Humphrey School audience. I've been associated with the Humphrey now since 1994, really, when Walter Mondale asked me to do something for the school. And it's one of the great strengths of the state of Minnesota, and I'm glad that I can continue to participate. Anxious to get right into this discussion about the new administration, the transition, but I want to say I'm so happy that my Mercury colleague, Trent Lefkowitz, is going to be here to join us today. Trent and I have worked together for 5 years now, and even though he's a Democrat, he tolerates me fairly well, so I think it'll go well today. Anyway.
Yeah. I just wanted to thank you as well, Larry. I've done a good amount of work with Vin in the past on the Humphrey Policy Fellows program in D.C., ensuring that they're meeting with interesting people and getting good meetings around D.C. So really appreciate the opportunity to speak with this group here today, share a little bit of insight about what we're seeing from D.C. and answer some questions. And like Vin said, I think that we are a pretty good tag team on these sorts of issues, even though we come from different political parties. So really appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Great. So let's start off by looking at what actually happened in the election and different points of view about it. The bottom line is Republicans like to talk about the fact that they won the trifecta, which I think it's such a parallel to what the Democrats had in Minnesota after the 2022 elections, where we had Governor Walz and Democrats in control of both houses of legislature. Now the Republicans in Washington have the presidency and both houses of the Congress. But in my view, the Republicans are a little bit overstating the magnitude of their victory. The Trump people, I understand this, are like to claim that it was a landslide victory. It was not really. The only way you can look at it as a landslide was in the Electoral College vote for Trump, where he did carry all the swing states and won a big majority. But he won just a narrow plurality, really, of the popular vote, just under 50%, but I think like a 1.5% margin. It's better than losing, but it's not exactly a mandate, and they're trying to claim it was a mandate. But the Republicans did carry 53 seats in the United States Senate. That's good. It's not the 60 seats you need to pass most legislation in the Senate, but it's a majority. It gives you confirmation power and all sorts of other things. The House of Representatives is very, very interesting because there's only a two-seat majority for the Republicans. Interestingly, if Republicans want to claim some kind of a mandate, the popular vote for the House of Representatives is actually a stronger indicator than the popular vote for president. The Republicans won the popular vote for the House of Representatives by about 2.5 points. That may not seem like a huge number, but it's bigger than the margin that they got in the popular vote for the presidents. So the Republicans can claim to have won. I think that they overstate the degree to which it was a landslide, but they certainly have won. And one of the things that I'm seeing from them is almost an unprecedented degree of unity behind a new president. So that they may have some substantial ability to enact their agenda. Trent, why don't you respond to that, and then we'll get on a little bit more to Minnesota and the Congress itself.
Yeah, so I would agree that Republican victories in the House and Senate are decisive, but not necessarily overwhelming. I think obviously in the Senate, there were several races that were very close, where if we had seen a true quote unquote red wave year, Republicans could have won seats in Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Arizona as well. That did not happen. Also, especially in the House, right now, the majority is only a five-seat majority. So there are 220 Republicans and 215 Democrats entering the next Congress. So that means that the Republicans can really only stand two defections in the House on any specific piece of legislation. Obviously, it's very important that Republicans control both chambers because the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader will be able to guide what is brought to the floor. And then Republicans will obviously as well have control over relevant committees of interest, which we'll talk a little bit about later. But I do think the fact that the majorities are so small is significant, especially as Vin said in the Senate, the 60-vote majority for a filibuster is still needed. And I think that there was something very interesting that happened early on in terms of the Senate Majority Leader race. There were three people that were in the running for the race. John Thune from South Dakota, John Cornyn from Texas, and Rick Scott from Florida. Rick Scott was viewed as the most quote unquote pro-Trump of the three candidates. He likely would have changed factors in the institution in order to advance the Trump agenda. He was the third place vote getter in the race, and it went to John Thune, who is somebody who will advance the president's agenda, but also has large respect for the institution of the Senate, has indicated that he will not try to overturn the filibuster at this point, and is somebody who, while trying to advance the president's agenda, might be more likely than a Rick Scott to push back in certain circumstances. So I think from a Democratic perspective, it's bad to say that Democrats are already looking to 2026. That shows just kind of the poor performance in 2024. But I think that people are thinking that if you can work with some moderate Republicans in both chambers, and if some of the positions that Trump has put forward on tariffs or other issues end up not being as popular as maybe they appeared in the campaign trail, that Democrats might not be as poorly positioned as they appear right now. So, Vin, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add to that before we talk about the Minnesota context.
No, I think that that's all right on target. And the only other thing I'd add, when you talked about those Senate races that Democrats won in states that Trump won, the last couple of cycles, we've looked at the elections and said, well, part of the problem is Republicans have really bad candidates. Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania 2 years ago was an example. That's not true this year in Michigan and Wisconsin, where Trump won and the Democrat Senate candidates won. Republicans had good candidates in those states, the best candidates they could recruit, and the Democrats still won. So it goes to the split nature of the electorate, I think, and why Republicans need to be a little bit humble about their victory. Let's move on just a little bit. I want to talk just about Minnesota for a few minutes because Minnesotans should feel good about their impact in the Congress in the next Congress. Amy Klobuchar just moved up to the number three position in the Senate among Democrats. Interestingly, a lot of speculation that positions her to be the Senate Democrat leader at some point in the future. But right now she's number three, and that's good. She has she's the well liked on both in both parties, on the Republican and on the Democrat side also. Betty McCollum, Congresswoman from the 4th District, is the ranking Democrat, the senior Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee, and also very well liked in both parties, and that gives Minnesota substantial clout. On the Republican side, Tom Emmer was reelected the whip, the number three Republican in the House of Representatives. That's significant. He ran for Speaker 2 years ago or something like that, and had a problem with Trump. That's been resolved. Trump, he now he's been down to Mar-a-Lago. He's been championing the Trump agenda, and so there's no light between Tom Emmer and the president. And that's good for him and good for Minnesota. Michelle Fischbach, who I'm particularly close to because she was my intern when I'm in college, I was in Congress, gives you an idea of how old I am. Anyway, Michelle is a member of the Policy and Steering Committee and has two very significant committee assignments, Ways and Means and Rules. I don't know that we have had a more significant combination of committee assignments for any member of Congress from Minnesota that I can recall. That's particularly powerful on the Rules Committee when you're in the majority, which Michelle is. And Pete Stauber from northeastern Minnesota is gaining in seniority and real authority on transportation and infrastructure issues. So Minnesota is well positioned as we go into the next Congress. That doesn't really address any of the partisan issues that we're going to talk about, but it means Minnesota has a strong position.
So can I jump in?
Sure.
And I want to shift to the national picture, and get your reactions to this. I think there was, some, I don't know, shock at some of the nominations by Donald Trump for cabinet appointments. And the reaction by many is this is unprecedented and so forth. And so I want to get your reaction to that idea and maybe talk about some of the individuals. But also I want to ask about the more general pattern, which is that presidents since, I don't know, at least Ronald Reagan and before have looked to cabinet appointments to people who are have personal loyalty to them and share policy preferences. If you don't do that, then how are you going to establish, a chain of command or some level of influence down into the, the bureaucracy? So is Trump's appointments, in your view, let's start with you, Vin, so out of line, or is it kind of a variation on a theme?
That's a good question. I'd view it. I have two answers to that question. First of all, I think you're right. I think that presidents should have people loyal to them to implement their policies. That's just part of democracy. If a president can get elected, if a president can get elected running on a certain set of promises and then can't keep any of them because of the people that are working for him, that's not good for democracy. So there's nothing wrong with having loyal people to you, and I think he's done that. But there's a second piece to that that I think, as you mentioned, a lot of these are controversial. I was surprised by many of them. They're not controversial just because they're loyal to Trump, though. They're controversial because of the word that's become very dominant in the Washington, D.C. debate these days, and that is they are disruptors. And the Trump wants disruptors. He doesn't want people that come out of strong academic and policy backgrounds in the areas where they will serve. And it's not just that he's ignorant of that. It's because he knows that those people will have loyalties to the past policies and the people that are in existence in those agencies. He doesn't want that. He thinks we're sort of in a different era where expertise is somewhat questionable, and where people think the government is too stodgy and needs to be shaken up. And that's what most of the people that he's appointed who are controversial, and some who are not, they fit into that category, and it's surprising to those of us that have been around watching Washington for a long time. And I don't the controversial ones are people like, Pete Hegseth and others, but others. But there are some that are not terribly controversial, but they're also disruptors. Linda McMahon is Secretary of Education. She's a highly qualified person for a lot of things, but no, I would never have guessed that she'd be in the Department of Education. And there's other people that I think fit that pattern as well. So yes, loyalty, I think that's good. I think I think we should strengthen the ability of the president to implement his policies through his appointees. The interesting issue is this part about the disruptors. Are they going to simply disrupt for the sake of chaos, or are they actually going to see changes in policy?
Yeah, and as a Democrat, I would say that there were some cabinet selections like Sean Duffy or Marco Rubio, where I might say I don't agree with them from a policy perspective, but they're incredibly well qualified. They're up to do the role. But I think that's something that's consistent with those folks and even other people that are more controversial from a Democratic perspective. And I'll add another D word to Vin's disruptors, is they're going to be all defenders of Trump as well. So if you look at people like Duffy and Hegseth, they both have extensive experience on television. I think that the president really values people that are able to develop and deliver messages with that audience. I think that that is something that he really values in people. People like Tulsi Gabbard and RFK Jr. are former Democrats who, now that they have kind of jumped sides, are more likely to defend him and kind of move forward with his agenda. And even people that might be viewed differently from a Democratic perspective, like Brooke Rollins, who's going to be leading agriculture, and Marco Rubio, who's going to be leading the State
State.
Department, they're people that, even if they have their own policy preferences, at the end of the day, they will ultimately be defending Trump publicly. And I think that's something that's consistent with his nominations and appointments, regardless of what their individual policy preferences are.
Great, thank you. There's a, I don't know, I would call it a fiction that the president appoints a cabinet. And people have this idea of a cabinet equivalent to what you would see in a parliamentary democracy. And in a parliamentary democracy, the legislature appoints the executive, and then out of that, the prime minister is selected. And what that means is that the cabinet is literally collective governance. They're the ones with the power. In America, we have something called separation of powers, and you've got a legislative branch, you've got an executive branch. And in the executive branch, there's a unitary president. He's calling the shots. So the idea that the cabinet and these nominees are kind of running things has always been a bit of a mystery, because the White House is very well established with the Office of Management and Budget and other procedures to keep control over what's happening, at least at a policy level. In the departments. And I'm just curious if you agree with that. And does that put even more emphasis on the kind of lower salient undersecretary appointments that might be plants by the White House to make sure that their policy is being pursued? Ben?
I think that's probably right. First of all, I think you've identified one of the key strengths of Americans' government and one of the key sources of occasional frustration, and that is that the founders were suspicious of any concentration of power, and they constructed a government consciously, which has a hard time moving in a sweeping direction all at once. We have a separation of powers. We have both a Senate and a House, and that's all by design. But when it frustrates people, because when they think that they're voting for a big change, they find it's very hard to get that. That's not what the founding fathers' intent was. And we're seeing a little bit of the friction on that coming out now on the president's putting forward all of his nominees. He would like them to all be rubber stamped by the Republican Senate, but the Republicans in the Senate are aware of the fact the Constitution gives them a role in this process, and they are reluctant to simply say yes to everything that Trump wants because they want to be true to their role under the Constitution. So I think it's a constant tension in America, but I think we're going to make it work pretty well, actually.
Trent, I want to ask you, because I already know Vin's view. He said it earlier. Do you think Trump's going to get his nominees confirmed in the Senate?
I think an overwhelming majority of them he will. And it's funny, depending on the day. Last week, it looked like Pete Hegseth was in much more trouble. And this week, people are talking about Tulsi Gabbard and RFK Jr. kind of being more problematic. But I think that a dynamic that exists is that members of the Senate feel a lot of grassroots pressure to be aligned with Trump and aligned with his cabinet nominees and appointees. And I think that people may feel comfortable saying no to one or two of them. But if they say no to too many of them, they could be portrayed as anti-Trump. And that leads them to then further pressure in terms of primaries and things of that nature. I think we're seeing it this week where a lot of grassroots pressure was placed onto Joni Ernst after she came out publicly kind of saying that she wasn't sure about whether or not she would vote to advance Pete Hegseth's nomination. She still hasn't indicated one way or another whether or not she would do so. But I think it's very interesting if you read the language of her comments last week versus this week. She's using much more broader language and talking about keeping an open mind, whereas the week before, before the pressure really kind of hit, that wasn't happening as much. So I do think that the large majority of them will. I think that we'll continue to see that if somebody is not going to move forward, they'll take themselves out of the running before a confirmation hearing takes place, like Matt Gaetz did. But I do think across the board, a lot of them will.
By the way, just a Minnesota point, I think most of our audience may be aware of this, but everybody that comes up for an appointment, they get what is in Washington parlance referred to as a Sherpa, somebody that shows you around the Senate and introduces you. The Sherpa for Pete Hegseth is our own Norm Coleman. You've probably seen him on when they cover Hegseth. Norm is always in that group, and he's a good choice in my view. I'm a friend of Norm's, but he's introducing her or him to senators across the board, and I think is a good choice. But I just think that's a point of Minnesota interest.
So for folks who aren't familiar with Norm's history, he was the mayor of the capital city in Minnesota, St. Paul, and then was a U.S. senator and has remained quite active in politics, and I believe still has a residence here in Minnesota.
He has one up north on the lake. I know that for sure.
Yeah, you see him around. There are a whole lot of questions here, and a lot of them focus on policy. And the policy that's getting the most attention with our group is tariffs. And there's a bunch of questions. Some of the questions are of the sort, what about the impact that these tariffs would have? In Minnesota, we, of course, have a large agricultural sector. There's a lot of concern about that and other states. We also have a number of businesses that are involved in retail who are, you know, near panicked about whether there would be a high tariff that would, you know, intervene and cause pain. Still trying to recover from the last Trump presidency. How certain are you that Trump is actually going to go forward with what he's talked about versus, you know, creating some sort of mechanism, as he did in his first term, where businesses could make an appeal, make their own argument as to why maybe they should be exempted? Vin, what's your thinking about the tariff policy?
Well, yeah, first of all, it's a big, big issue. Trump has said that his number one policy concern is the border, and we could talk about that. But number two is tariffs. And there's no shortage of discussion about tariffs. And there's a big debate, I think, about going on about what goes on inside Trump's head on tariffs. Either does he really believe we should have tariffs, implement them, period, full stop, or is he using them entirely as negotiating points to try to get concessions on other issues? And nobody knows for sure the answer to that. I think that there's going to be flexibility on a lot of his tariff decisions. Now, I say that as somebody that represented an agricultural district in Minnesota, Larry, and as you pointed out, you know, the notion that we would apply tariffs was just horrendous to me when I was in Congress, because the farmers would be the major victims of any substantial interruption of international trade for the United States. I always said there's nothing, the farm bill may be important, but there's nothing more important to farm income than their ability to export their product. And if we interfere with that, we're doing a lot of damage to a constituency that gave Trump a very substantial majority of their vote. So, you know, I have to believe there's some flexibility on that. The one area where I think we're really going to see tariffs is China. And I don't say that that's exclusive of what I just said, because we sell a lot of agricultural products to China, too. But there's a difference in attitude toward China than there is almost anything else. And particularly because it's one area where you'll probably see a lot of Democrat support for whatever strategy Trump wants. The attitudes toward China in this country, as you're well aware, have changed so dramatically in the last several years that it's likely that we will have substantial tariffs trying to impact Chinese behavior.
Trent, I'm going to just ask you specifically if you followed the kind of opt-out process in the first Trump presidency. I think it was out of Commerce, where you had firms kind of making their case, and a number of them got exemptions, or they got kind of reductions. And this became kind of a safety valve of sorts. Now, did you follow that, or you have any sense whether?
Yeah, I follow it somewhat. It's an important just to talk to people that care about trade policy. There's a tendency to think that the United States Trade Representative, because that's the name of that agency, is the main focus of trade policy in the United States. It's little known, but there are far more people in the Department of Commerce dedicated to the issue of trade than there are in the entire office of the U.S. Trade Representative. And their motivations are quite different. Their motivation is not necessarily to do trade deals, which is the job of the USTR, the Trade Representative. It's to promote U.S. business. So there, I think there'll be a lot of focus on that. And that's a place where everybody should try to, that cares about being able to do business internationally, should try to have an impact, because I think they can have an impact. And Trump does, you know, whatever you think about Trump, he doesn't want to hurt business. I mean, he's a business guy. He wants to do well. He probably, particularly people that have supported him, he wants to do favors for his friends. I think that there's a lot of flexibility.
So just to come back to your point initially, this is a way Trump to do it, both in terms of something he cares about, but also to have the pragmatism to provide flexibility in situations that he and his staff might think justified.
He wants to do deals. That's what I mean. His book is The Art of the Deal.
Yeah.
He doesn't. He's not confrontational in the sense of, I'm going to lay down a firm marker and don't cross it or you're dead. He wants to do deals. Trent, what do you think on the Democrat side about that?
Yeah, so I think that one of the points that you brought up, Vin, that I think is very interesting in terms of USTR versus Commerce and Treasury, is that the person who is viewed as the chief architect of Trump's tariff policy in his first administration is a man by the name of Bob Lighthizer. He served as the United States Trade Representative. And from my perspective, it's very notable that he is not getting a senior position in the new Trump administration. There had been reports in D.C. that he was angling for Commerce Secretary or Treasury Secretary, precisely because of Vin's point that Commerce has very significant oversight over trade. And if you look at the two people that were given those posts, Howard Lutnick and Scott Bessent, those are viewed as much more kind of traditional Wall Street economist type folks, and less of a disruptor like Lighthizer. Lighthizer's former chief of staff, Jameson Greer, was named the United States Trade Representative this year. But something that I've seen is that that title itself might be demoted from the cabinet and report directly to the Commerce Department. And so I think that that's something that's very interesting to see, whether or not Trump's rhetoric on tariffs is really true, that he believes it, or whether or not he has people in his cabinet that are more traditional economists that might kind of push back on some of those impulses. So
there are lots of great questions here, so we're going to get to as many as we can. One of the questions is about the moral issues or personal issues associated with some of the cabinet nominees: heavy drinking, sexual assault, and so forth. Why is not why is what's going on there? I mean, did the Trump administration Trump transition not care? They not do investigations? They cared about other things. Why weren't they disqualified? I mean, it's hard to imagine, for instance, one of the Bush presidents nominating some of these folks based on those issues. Why is it different?
Well, that's hard to answer. I mean, short answers. I don't know the answer to the question, but I do think that Trump, because he has been so criticized for his personal life, is not necessarily immune to that, but he's reluctant to sink people because of accusations about their personal life. And we all remember from the 2016 campaign the Access Hollywood tape, the issue against Trump and the lawsuits about harassment and worse. So that's just my guess, is that he's reluctant to take that stand hard against people that he nominated. That may be a mistake, but that's what I think. I also would say I think that the media is more willing to vent those issues now than they were in the past. We've had a lot of people put up for high office in the past. Elected to Congress in the past, who had personal issues, but they were kept quiet. And it's not possible to keep any of those things quiet anymore.
And I would just add that if any of Trump's additional cabinet nominees and appointees sink, it won't necessarily be because of what they're accused of, but because they become too much of a political liability for Trump. So we'll see some folks that get through with large articles in the Wall Street Journal or Washington Post or New York Times criticizing some of their moral issues. And the ones that don't will just be because the political pressure was too much. And it'll look better for Trump to either remove the nomination or for the person like Matt Gaetz to take themselves out of consideration, as opposed to seeing Republicans vote against them in a committee or on the Senate floor.
Let me pick up maybe somewhat of a related theme, which is several questions on whether the cabinet nominees are qualified for the roles they've been put up for, and whether they are going to do harm to the institutions that they're supposed to take responsibility for. Now, Vin, I think implicit in what you were saying is harm is in the eye of the beholder. Donald Trump may be looking to disrupt. If you think the institution is doing the right thing, you may see that as harm. But how do you see that? One of the questions said, it seems as if Donald Trump's nominees, there's a dumpster everywhere that's on fire.
That's not unfair. I mean, and yeah, you're right, Larry. That's what I was sort of referring to when I talked about the disruptor influence. A lot, Trump, and not just Trump, a lot of people in the Trump world very much want to disrupt these institutions. They think that they're ossified, they think they're bloated, they think that they have their own agenda, and it doesn't matter what the president thinks, they're going to do what they want to anyway. That's why you have this talk all the time about the phrase the deep state. Which is, I guess in some ways it can be offensive, but it's not untrue. I remember way back when a great friend of mine was Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the ambassador to the United Nations. And I remember Jean was a dear friend of mine. She said, I remember she gave a speech once saying, calling for the abolition of the career foreign service. And people were shocked. And she said, no, the president can't conduct foreign policy if he can't appoint the people that are implementing it. And her point was that in her time as as a diplomat, an ambassador of the United Nations, she found the State Department constantly undermining the foreign policy of the president. Well, expand that to all the agencies of government, and that's a justification. Now, you can take that way too far and sort of just want to destroy the existing institutions of government, and that's not where I want to see us go. But I do think that there is a certain desire to disrupt a great deal. And I think that leads to another point that I'd make, which we should talk about a little bit, which is Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy's DOGE, they call it, Department of Government Efficiency. They are a disruptor influence. They're going to talk about scaling back and disarming a lot of these agencies. That and if Musk believes what he says, he thinks that most of them could just be abolished. I don't think that, but I think that there is a sense that we've gone too far without it trying to reform any of these institutions, and better to overshoot by putting people in there that are ready to start a dumpster fire, as opposed to somebody that's just going to, tend to business as usual.
Trent?
Yeah, so I think from a Democratic perspective, the nominations that have received the largest backlash are the ones that people perceive as doing the most harm. So RFK Jr., for example, as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I think Democrats feel very strongly that somebody who has expressed skepticism of vaccines might not be suitable to lead that organization. Similarly, Pete Hegseth, the Department of Defense, Democrats feel strongly that somebody who may have indicated lapses in moral judgment might not be qualified to lead the world's largest military. I do think that there is an interesting dynamic, though, because for the purposes of confirmation hearings, it doesn't quite matter what Democrats think because they will likely vote en bloc or they might join to vote Republicans. What really does matter is whether there are moderate Republicans or Republicans that really care about specific issues that that are interested in maybe saying no to these. Joni Ernst is the example that I pulled earlier about Hegseth, where she was a member of the armed services. She's spoken out very strongly about sexual assault in the armed services before. And I think Democrats are really relying on people like that in the Republican Party to be outspoken and maybe might be more inclined to stay quiet and let those items work out kind of within the Republican Party. So.
Thank you. Vin, you were involved and connected when Ronald Reagan was elected, and there was a sense of really a generational agenda. And you might even draw some parallels with what Trump is proposing, at least initially, this sense of broad change. There's some level of agreement, at least at the elite level in the Republican Party and among Trump's closest supporters. And we've got several questions here kind of pick up on that. And the theme is the Project 2025 and the changes that it has proposed on a number of fronts, including instituting traditional family values, including making some very deep cuts into the federal workforce and climate change. How do you view that? Do you see, just first off at the general level, do you see what Trump is doing as a generational agenda, or is this kind of, a president coming in with his ideas, but maybe not kind of the sweeping change that is being described?
I think it's pretty sweeping. I think in my lifetime, there have been three movements leading to elections that fundamentally changed the Republican Party. The first one was I was in junior high school, it was Barry Goldwater, and he lost the election massively, but he did take over the Republican Party. It no longer was the party of Northeastern and Midwestern moderate to liberal Republicans, Rockefellers, people like Harold Lamander in Minnesota. It became the party of the South and the Southwest and much, much, much more conservative. And Goldwater lost the election, but he'd shifted permanently, really, the control of the Republican Party to a more conservative base. The second one was Ronald Reagan, who took that same dynamic, expanded it, and won the presidency by a, he could genuinely claim a landslide. And the Republican Party was cemented then as a different kind of party. Trump is the third. He's changed the Republican Party, and I don't mean in Congress, I mean at the grassroots level. The average Republican that writes letters or emails to their congresspeople and gets out and puts bumper stickers on cars or lawn signs, those people are now more or less Trump Republicans. And that's, so it's the, that's the third big grassroots movement that I've witnessed change the direction of the party substantially, and I think that it's real.
And so when you've described this, you've looked at kind of the politics and the constituencies behind each of these three presidents. How about in terms of the policy? The Project 2025 has been described as kind of the roadmap for Trump. For Ronald Reagan, it was a kind of government is the problem. For Goldwater, there was that. I mean, it was really just a very bracing libertarian vision after the New Deal.
And a hawkish foreign policy.
Hawkish. How would you describe Trump? Is there, a kind of a policy or ideological project here to go along with the political change?
There is a policy, but it's a little different than what we saw in that previous decades that I described in terms of Goldwater and Reagan. I mean, his emphasis on stopping foreign wars and getting out of foreign conflicts. On the one hand, it's hard to argue with that. Nobody likes war, nobody likes killing, but it's very much at odds with the way the Republican Party has been viewed for a long, long time. Republicans were always the hawkish party, the Democrats were the dovish party. And now all of a sudden, we've got the Republican president saying that one of his top priorities is to end all these foreign wars. He's suspect for wanting to sell out Ukraine just to get a deal with the Russians. I don't know if I believe that or not, but that attitude toward foreign policy seems to be a change, although there are qualifiers I'd put on that. And on economic policy, tariffs is a big change. I mean, we were the free trade party all those years. All of a sudden now, the question is, do we have a free trade party? The Democrats always have been a little difficult on that because of the influence of organized labor in their politics. But now the Republicans are, moving in a protectionist direction too. If indeed that, but we get back to the question we raised earlier. Is Trump doing this because he really wants to be protectionist, or does he just want to get his negotiating position strengthened? But it's definitely a change in the way that the party thinks about things.
Right. Trent, I want to ask you about it's actually a question here, which is how successful is Trump going to be? When he came in last time, there was lots of ideas that he put out there and in kind of flamboyant ways, including he was going to build a wall all across the almost 2,000-mile border. The new wall came in, I think, at 55 feet or something. It was, he was setting an agenda and mobilizing people behind it. But the question here is this administration going to succeed, or as in the past, is it going to make strong statements and fall short?
Yeah, so I think just touching on the end of the last question, then I'll answer this one. I'm somewhat skeptical that Project 2025 is going to be a comprehensive roadmap for Trump policy. And the main factor being is that he didn't write it. Certainly, people that are affiliated with him were involved in the consultations and shaping it. But if you saw on the campaign trail, he did a lot of distancing from Project 2025, not just because Democrats were attacking it, but I also believe that he didn't want his name being used for something that he might not agree with 100%. I think something that we see with Trump is that he's more transactional than ideological. That's a point that goes back to Vin's earlier comment stating that he views himself as a deal maker. And I think that there are some core tenets on immigration and tariffs, energy, revitalizing U.S. manufacturing, where Trump has very strong opinions, and other issues where he's not as ideological or traditionally conservative. Interestingly, I think that at least on the tariff issue, if Trump is successful on tariffs, it may lead to failures in 2026. Because if Trump does place tariffs on Canada and Mexico, in addition to China, and it increases prices on everyday goods for Americans, there will be widespread public backlash to it. Because I think that a lot of the reason why many Americans voted for Trump this cycle is because they were being hit by inflation. The cost of household goods they felt was higher than it was early in the Biden administration, and they wanted somebody that could make those changes. And if Trump comes in and implements these policies and those issues not only don't get better, but they get worse, I think that we could be seeing something that has interesting implications for subsequent elections and how people in DC might be willing to stand up to Trump policy-wise.
Vin, there's been quite a bit of discussion in general, but also during the campaign about the Democratic Party support for policies around issues around diversity, equity, and inclusion, generally wrapped in the phrase of wokeness. Trump ran a kind of widely commented and seen ad about the they them with regards to
Right.
Kamala Harris. Do you think that's actually going to translate into policy? Is there going to be an effort to kind of zero out spending on these kind of woke policies and Department of Education and maybe the Pentagon and elsewhere?
I do. But let's qualify a little bit. I've thought since 2016, when Trump first emerged and everybody was trying to analyze what was Trump's appeal, and most of the discussion at that time was the economically ignored Rust Belt is rallying behind Donald Trump. And I spent some time up in northern Minnesota, which is a classic area of the country that went from being largely Democratic to very strongly Trump, and talked to people up there, well, all the time. And I didn't ever get much about economically being ignored. I got cultural stuff. They think that they're being looked down upon and told how to live by people that think that they're smarter than they are. I don't, excuse me, I was born and raised in rural Minnesota. I've got a house in northern Minnesota. I do not think these people are all bigots. I do think they're tired of being told that their thinking is wrong and their language is wrong and their behavior is wrong by people that work for the government. So I think that that's real. Now, and I do think that when the Doge Project and others starts looking at things that they can zero out in government, anything that is connected to DEI or anything like that is going to be a prime target to get eliminated. Let me add one last point, though, in terms of Donald Trump. It shouldn't be lost on people that he has appointed the first woman as White House Chief of Staff. It shouldn't be lost on people that he has appointed a gay married man with children as Secretary of Treasury. These are not the actions of somebody that is a reflexive bigot. I just doubt that.
Has he
I would.
appointed any cabinet secretaries or people of color?
Well, he's got three Hindus in his secretary. I don't think he's got a black person in the secretary, but I don't know. Maybe Trent, do you know about that?
I think I don't know if he has any African Americans, but I believe that Lori Durhamer Chavez, who's going to be the
Yeah.
labor secretary, might be
Yes.
a person of color. I agree with Vince's point that about Trump maybe not necessarily having personal biases in that regard. But I do think that the kind of anti-woke culture that he has fostered and kind of stoked creates an environment and an infrastructure where conservative activists can use the courts to kind of advance their own anti-woke agenda. So even if it's not coming from the White House directly, I think people will be emboldened by what they see as Trump maybe turning a blind eye to some discrimination regarding transgender youth or LGBTQ people or minorities to advance their own bigoted agendas, even if it is not the main widespread belief held by the Republican Party.
Vin, you talked about the effort, let's say, for instance, by the Elon Musk and Ramaswamy, when they're looking for where to cut, it may be on the woke policies, diversity, equity, inclusion. Do you think that that orientation is going to filter down into the states? So, for instance, in Minnesota, the Republican Party will now have the ability to block budgets unless they can be brought on board because the House is now tied. Do you think that would you expect, for instance, using that case, that you might expect the Republican Party in Minnesota to be following a similar agenda, kind of seeking out and taking out DEI programs?
Yes, I think you're exactly right. I think that will happen in Minnesota. I think it'll happen almost everywhere at the state level. National trends tend to filter down to the state level, and sometimes, as maybe this is apropos of what Trent just said, express themselves in a more virulent form at the state level than they do at a national level. So I think that that's entirely possible. And one more reason why I think that's possible. I think that I've had some of my colleagues in Mercury, not Trent, but others, Democrats say, oh, DOGE is irrelevant because they're not a government agency. I take exactly the opposite point of view. They're not a government agency, which allows Elon Musk to put resources into it. And
Yeah.
we know that when Elon Musk cares about something, look, He put a quarter of $1 billion of his own money in the Trump campaign. He didn't like what was happening with Twitter, so he bought the company. I mean, I have to believe that this project called Doge is not just going to sit on the shelf and collect dust. He's going to put resources behind it, and if that means attacking DEI related programs, it'll filter down to all sorts of people.
Trent, I'm hoping you can help me. I've got a bunch of questions here saying, hey, wait, I thought you guys were going to tell us about the chairs in Congress and the committee structure. Could you help us out there? What do you expect there to be a change in terms of who's the chairs of committees in the House and the Senate, and who are the ranking members, of importance? Are there going to be shifts that we need to know about?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Obviously, in the House, because Republicans are maintaining control of the chamber, there won't be as many changes as there will be in the Senate, where the ranking members will become chairs. I think that right now we're in the middle of seeing some of these things play out. So, for example, Brett Guthrie, who's a member of Congress from Kentucky, was just named the Energy and Commerce Committee chair. The member of Congress from Washington State, who previously chaired that committee, Kathy McMorris Rogers, retired this year. I don't think that there will necessarily be a lot of differences in Republican policy on that side. But I think what happens is that people may have individual policy preferences or areas where they specifically care more about things that come to light when they become a committee chair. For example, I would look at the House Foreign Affairs Committee, where Brian Nast from Florida was just named the chair. He is somebody who I think might be more interested in oversight and kind of military issues because he is a former military veteran than some of the other people who were in the running for the position. But I think that largely speaking, the real power in these committees and subcommittees is that the chairs now have the authority to bring legislation to the table, vote on it, and send it to the floor. And it's easier for them to do that now that the House and Senate leadership are united. Vin, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. The House is a little different than the Senate in that in the House of Representatives, Republicans term limit their committee chairman. They don't do that in the Senate, and they don't do it on the Democratic side at all. And that affects some committees. The most notable one, and I don't know that it will result in a change in policy, but Virginia Fox has been the chairman of the Education Committee and the ranking Republican on it before that. For many years, she is term limited off. She was a very influential. Well, is she's not, she's still in the Congress. She's just not the chairman of the Education Committee anymore. But that will mean some significant change, probably in the focus and professionalism of the House Education Committee. We have a lot of interests in Minnesota that care about education. Well, the whole country does, but Minnesota is particularly attuned to that. So we have to pay attention to. We don't know yet who's going to be the chairman there. Burgess Owens from Utah is probably the leading contender, but not necessarily a done deal. That's probably where we're looking. Agriculture matters a lot to us. That's going to be just fine. By the way, Brad Finstead from Minnesota is not going to be the chairman of the committee because he's only in his second term, but he's already emerged as one of the most influential members of the House Agriculture Committee, owing to the fact that he is a family farmer and worked for the Department of Agriculture in the state of Minnesota for many years. So those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about.
One other thing that I would add, Larry, too, is that it's important to look at the committee leadership's kind of attitudes and relationships towards Trump as well to get a sense of what their agenda might look like. So, for example, the new chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee is going to be Tom Cotton. He's replacing Marco Rubio, obviously, who was named Secretary of State. From what I understand, Rubio and his staff had really good working relationships with Mark Warner and their counterparts on the Intelligence Committee. Tom Cotton is viewed as much more of a firebrand, and maybe it's harder for him to work across the aisle with Democrats, and maybe he will be doing things that are a little bit more ostentatious to show support for the Trump administration than previous people may have done. So I think that's an interesting dynamic to take a look at.
I think that's right. That's, you have to always factor in not just the ideology of these people, but their personality type. And I think Cotton is a very smart guy. But you're right, he doesn't shy from a fight. And that's a different relationship. I know the previous chairman pretty well, Tom, and he's a good guy and he's a very collegial guy. But Cotton will be a little more provocative.
We've got a couple questions here related to some specific factions within the House. One question is, will the House Freedom Caucus sabotage the Republican leadership as they did during the last sessions?
That's a really good question. And you know, if you looked at the behavior of the Freedom Caucus in the last Congress, you'd say, yeah, that's a real threat. And I think it still is a real threat because the margins are even narrower now. But a couple of things are different. One, the ringleader of most of that is gone, masked. And more importantly than that, the Republicans have the presidency. So the we'll see if that dynamic holds. I think it was easy for the Freedom Club to take on their leadership when there was no implications for a president of their own party. And in fact, they were egged on occasionally by the former president of their own party on the, from the outside. Now they have to think every time they try to disrupt things and slow things down because of an overturning of leadership, it's going to impact Trump and his agenda, and he's not going to be happy about it. And I have to believe that that will have a substantial impact, but it's yet to be seen.
I've got a last question, but first let me just add something one of our friends in the audience shared with us, Rita Weingartner. Little fact check. She said Scott Turner is a person of color who has been appointed or nominated to HUD.
My apologies. I should have thought of that. I knew that
And
actually.
me as well. Trent, I want to ask you, there the theme running through questions, I would assume, from Democrats we have, and you hear it all the time, which is Donald Trump's administration is going to bring an end to democracy. It's going to put the country's economy and well-being in worse shape in 4 years than where it is now. Do you share that pessimism?
I don't necessarily share the pessimism about end of democracy. I think that that was a losing argument in the presidential election, in that Democrats were using that rhetorically, but and then in their actions were kind of saying otherwise. So, for example, Biden welcomed Trump for a transfer of power meeting in the White House after he was elected. If Democrats truly, truly thought that Trump was a threat to democracy, I don't believe that would have happened. But I do think that there are a lot of significant policies that Republicans could undergo in the next Congress administration, whether it's on these social issues that we discussed, or tariffs, or foreign policy, that could have significant negative implications for the American people. And I think that it's important for Democrats to frame issues less broadly as a threat to democracy and more narrowly as a threat to individual households or constituencies, because I think that will be more effective in mobilizing support to counter some of those efforts.
Well, this has been a great conversation. We have a lot more questions here, and as I do. So I want to thank both of you for joining us. And Trent, I absolutely want to publicly thank you for all the time you volunteer to put into the Policy Fellows. And those of you who don't know this program, search Policy Fellows, Humphrey School of Public Affairs. It's a program that's been around for 35 years. Vin and Tim Penny co-directed it for a dozen. It's just remarkable political diversity. You've got folks who are civilians and military. It's got 30 to 40% people of color and new Americans. It really is, I think, a very hopeful program. And Vin, I want to also thank you. You just, even though you're not co-directing, it feels like you're co-directing because you're so involved in that. And Vin and I have started a series called Conservative Voices, and that's been, I think, an absolutely terrific contribution to making sure we have intellectual diversity at the University of Minnesota. And the response has been, I think, terrific in Minnesota. So thank you on all those fronts. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Larry, just quickly, I misspoke a second ago when I talked about the House of Representatives, and I said it was because Brian Mast was gone. I just misspoke. I meant Matt Gaetz. My apologies.
Thank you. Just a couple of closing comments as we wrap up here. I want to let you know if you'd be interested in a recording of this, it is available, will be available in a day or two. It's a podcast on all your favorite platforms. And please feel free to review our series, Dialogue Across Difference. Those reviews help to draw attention to these programs, and you'll see it's they're a lot, and they're, I think, pretty wide-ranging. Also want to welcome you, particularly as we come to the end of the year, to consider making a donation. All of our events are free. They do cost money, though. We pay many of our speakers, as well as having to compensate travel and other things. So please consider that. Once again, big thanks, Trent Lefkowitz, Vin Weber, and all of you for joining us.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Larry. Take care.